Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasi Okalski. Sorry,
I'm
I was
so
eating
glad.
Something.
Today is March 25th, 2024, and our theme today on the radio is food stories.
That's why I was pretending to eat something.
Oh, I see. Oh, what a week. I went to a wonderful storytelling event yesterday at Susan Gordon's house. I was there listening to Chris Potts tell a version of the life of Sarah Grimke and a little bit about her sister, Angelina Grimke, who were suffragists and abolitionists late 1700s, early 1800s, and it was quite wonderful. There were about 20 people there to hear the story, and we had a meal of sorts and wonderful conversation, and we got to ask lots of questions about the story and tell Chris Potts what we wanted to hear more of and how excited we are. And she hopes to go on a tour of New England to the Grimke's stomping grounds and tell that story all over up there.
Sounds like it was a good day.
Yeah, it was a great day. Diane Macklin was there.
Oh.
And various other people that you know. But tell me about your week.
Busy.
Or weekend.
Well, we got notified this week that there was an opening at Harmony in right here where we live, 2 miles from our house, a beautiful, beautiful sister living place that we had gone and visited and put our name on the list. They have an opening. There's a space available for my brother. Bit bigger than what we really wanted, but if we can move him in there, then he will be first or second in line for a smaller room than when it opens up. So it'd be worth the effort. It'll also save us wear and tear on our bodies for this 200-mile round trip that we make. It seems like three or four times a month, and some months it's been even more. And it is very hard. It's hard enough on me. Just even just sitting in the car for a 200-mile trip has gotten to be a chore. And but it's also difficult because of all the moving in and out of hospital things. And we're going to have, hopefully by the 13th of April, we'll be done, and he'll be in a new beautiful home with better facilities and all kind of good stuff.
That's great news.
Yep, it is. So
Tony's going to visit the house today.
No, Tony's not. We are.
Oh, okay.
he's perfectly happy to do what we want.
Okay, I thought you had already seen it.
We have seen it, but we are going today to talk about details.
Right.
You know, that's we have great. To figure out, because it'll be a different pricing structure stuff. This is a much bigger place. The place he's in now has 14 people in a single home in, mm-hmm. you know, one house. And this place has, I don't know how many rooms, two floors of rooms. It's a big building. When we visited it, I thought of it as much nicer than most hotels I've ever stayed in.
Mm-hmm.
much nicer than any hotels I've ever stayed in. And they have a full staff. They have medical people on duty all the time. They have, you know, a wonderful dining room where they serve their breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Plus, they have snacks available. Plus, they have lots and lots and lots of activities, you know. And they even have a movie theater. And anyway.
Excellent. Very good.
He will think he's been promoted to king. And he's happy about it because then he'll be closer to us. And it's so close, I'll be able to see him anytime I want. You know, it'll require getting in the car and take 5 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it'll be, and then the VA hospital is right down the road. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank Andy Offit Irwin for opening our show today with his song, Tarry Here. And thank all our listeners out there in Radio Land who are listening to us. But do you want to talk about Speak or do you want to go right into a story?
Well, I think we should make an announcement about Speak.
I did see Adam yesterday. He was there to hear Chris Potts.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
That's good. Well, I was tempted by great thoughts of that because I, you know, I did look into Chris Potts and saw she looks very interesting storyteller. However, traveling has driven me crazy lately. I didn't even go to see my grandson play ball on Saturday, and it was the final game of the season. Just too much. Anyway, on April 9th, Antonio Roja. And anyone who's ever seen him will want to tune into that show. Anyone who, I mean, will want to come into Shepherdstown to see Antonio on the 9th of April, 7:30 at the Community Center in Shepherdstown. And he is one of the finest storytellers in the country. And his stories are phenomenal. I have seen him a number of times in Pennsylvania, in Jonesboro, Tennessee, and he's always a delight. So information can be gotten at www.speakstoryseries.com, and you can find out anything you want to know about our Speak Story series and sign up for an season ticket or donate money if you want, sponsor a storyteller, apply to tell a story, and just get a ticket and show up. It's also available by Zoom. And in May, on May 14th, we will have Elizabeth Rose, and I'm also looking forward to her. So,
May 14th?
Yes.
That's not the usual schedule, is it?
That's not a Tuesday?
It probably is. I never mind. I got confused there in the middle.
It is a Tuesday. Yeah.
Sure it is. Okay. Adam wouldn't make that mistake.
No, I might make that mistake, but I don't mind. And if I made that mistake, then I would have to quit. Because I usually know the dates.
Yes, you do. Numbers. You are whiz with numbers. I am not.
Numbers.
That's my mistake. Tell us a story, Sash.
All right. I love this topic about food. Because over the years, I have placed a great deal of emphasis on food. not because I have any culinary skills, or certainly not because anyone would say, oh, that's Dash. Boy, does he have taste in food. People would probably say, oh, that's Dash. You should see some of the stuff he eats. Or something like that. Because I have never, well, I shouldn't say never, until I met my wife, Terry Lee, who is a wonderful cook and who is not afraid of trying anything new. I mean, the first time I ever saw something called quiche, or even then put some of it in my mouth, was because of when I started dating Terry. And she invited me to her house, and she cooked a quiche and put it in front of me. It was delicious. Since then, I have tasted many, many, many things that I would not even have considered ever in my life. And then the only thing that was a dismal failure was Terry once took me to a really nice restaurant in Frederick, an Italian restaurant, and convinced me that I should try a portobello mushroom. I believe it was stuffed with something, because I told her I didn't really care for mushrooms. I had tasted them and I didn't like them. And she went to all the trouble to take me to this restaurant and ordered a beautiful dinner and everything. And I didn't care for it. And it was my last attempt to try to like mushrooms. Occasionally I do eat mushrooms on pizza or something like that, but I just have them go by my lips and tongue and that, and I don't pay attention to them.
No, so, mushrooms at all?
I would never eat a mushroom on purpose. If my wife serves something with mushrooms in it, I will certainly do my best to eat it, because I appreciate how hard she works, and her cooking is wonderful. But I just have no desire to eat a mushroom, because to me they don't taste like anything. But that's just me, and it's okay, because I found out that it doesn't mean I'm an idiot. It means I'm just different than other people, because there are some people who cook dinner. There are some people, for instance, who would never want to eat chanina, which is, I've told the story about my girlfriend in high school eating the chanina at our Thanksgiving dinner, and she liked it so much. And then she said, what's in it? And I looked at my mother and with imploring eyes, begged my mother with my eyes, please don't tell her. But my mother just smiled at me with a beautiful, sweet, middle-aged lady smile, and I knew she was going to kill me. So she said, oh dear, it's made with duck's blood, which sent Jane excusing herself on the table and going to the lavatory, where she finished her meal. Yes. And then I took her home. So, and my mother said, gee, I didn't think that would upset her. Knowing it would. Because nobody wants to hear stuff like that if they're not used to that kind of cooking. Anyway, I love chanina. Turned out Jane didn't, and I understand that. So, but on the subject of food, I thought I would tell a little bit about food and schools. Of course, in elementary school, I ate breakfast, a quick breakfast at home, then walked to school just a few blocks through the city. I went to a Catholic elementary school. And then I would be home at lunchtime. We had to go home for lunch. We didn't have a cafeteria. Later on in my elementary school, there were some kids who did bring lunch, and they could stay in the cafeteria and would be monitored by the nuns and eat a bag lunch. But I still ran home to the couple blocks and had a regular lunch. But the main part of my story is about lunch in schools, where I was going to school when I had to have lunch in school. I went to a Catholic Boys High School, Christian Brothers School in Baltimore, Maryland. 1,200 boys, downtown Baltimore. I had to ride a bus to get there. And I loved that school. My mother and father chose, my mother chose the school. It wasn't the one I wanted to go to, but it turned out to be great for me because I was able to play soccer. I made the varsity team as a freshman, and I made a lot of great friends. And the best thing about lunch at Calvert Hall was Fridays. Being a Catholic school, and in those days, this was the 50s, I went there from 55 to 59, Fridays was, no meat day. At that time, the Catholics were forbidden to eat meat on Fridays. And never understood it when I was a kid. Don't know why it went away. Caused me some grief at times. Not very much, because my mother was a good, really good cook, and I liked seafood. But at Calvert Hall on Fridays, it was a treat. My mother would give me 50 cents on Friday, 10 cents extra. Actually, she gave me 60 cents, but the 10 cents every day was for bus fare because we had to ride a regular streetcar bus, a city bus. We didn't have school buses for the private schools. But on Friday, there was a special treat for me as far as I was concerned. It was the best lunch, just marvelous lunch, because at that Catholic school, the brothers were smart. They didn't hire people to run the kitchen, from the Culinary Institute or something. What they did was they would hire some moms who didn't have a job regularly, but who were good cooks, and who wanted their son to go to Calvert Hall. So if the moms worked there, the sons got a break on tuition. Plus, the moms got paid. And there was nothing like having moms to fix lunch instead of, just ordinary lunch fixers who work for a living. And so in high school, my Friday lunch was for 50 cents, I got a half a grilled cheese sandwich, a half a tuna salad sandwich on toast, a half a chicken salad sandwich on toast, a bowl of tomato soup, and bag of potato chips, plus a soft drink. For 50 cents, I got those six items. And I was never hungry. It was delicious. The sandwiches, I could have gotten a whole sandwich. I could have gotten three whole sandwiches. But I didn't, because somebody's calling me and I don't know why. I'm going to let it go to voicemail.
And what a great ringtone.
Yeah. Law and order.
Law and order, right?
All right. So anyway, my high school lunches were just marvelous. And I took a lot of teasing on about my lunch on Friday, because 4 days a week, I had a bologna sandwich and a small bag of chips and usually another little treat, something in the vegetable kind of thing, or maybe a fruit. I wound up for 4 years, pretty much our lunch table for 4 years were pretty much the same, except when we were seniors, one of the guys who had been a year ahead of us had graduated, so we replaced him with somebody else. But other than that, I ate lunch with the same guys every day. It was a lot of fun. We talked about sports, we talked about school, and we often talked about the food. And they marveled at the fact that I did not get bored with bologna sandwiches. And if it wasn't for living with a person whom I love dearly and who takes care of me so well and looks out for my health, I would be eating bologna sandwiches today. But we don't get bologna anymore. We have a better kind of menu for that. So that's just my opening story. There you go. And I have more, but I'll go after you.
Okay. Well, I should say, I guess, that you've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasi Olkowski.
And our theme today is food stories. And I decided early on, thinking about this topic, that I wanted to talk about greens, because the health group that I belong to, that where we attend weekly, there are just 6 or 7 of us right now. Sometimes we've been as many as 20, and sometimes as few as 4, but right now we have pretty good numbers. And one of the things we do each month, we meet every week, but we change things up from month to month. And we always have a vegetable and a fruit of the month. And in March, our vegetable for the month was greens. And one of the things I've discovered is that different people have different understanding of what that word means. So for me, it's always meant green leafy vegetables. And there are so many stories about green leafy vegetables of all kinds, but it doesn't mean that same thing to other people. Some people think it just means vegetables. They don't even have to be green. So I have this wonderful book that I love telling stories from. It's called Vegetables in the Garden and Their Legends. It's by a woman named Vernon Quinn. And I have told stories from Vernon Quinn before, some of them about greens. But this time I thought I would do a more comprehensive look at what Vernon Quinn calls greens. And also look at some of the recipes. So I'm going to read the introduction to this book that's on the flap of the book cover. At last, the vegetable comes into its own. So long taken as a symbol of the phlegmatic and the prosaic, it is now revealed as a thoroughly exciting member of the plant family. Dexterously, delightfully, it's traced to its legendary lair with all the facts of life from ancient whispers of magic powers down to present-day botanical accuracy. Those who love gardens and know plants seem to have a special gift for noting the unusual, and Vernon Quinn is no exception. Her interest and her knowledge are inexhaustible. The mere origin and present status of vegetables do not satisfy her. She goes on ferreting out the romantic tales and even traces the sources of their names. Here is a veritable compendium of fascinating facts and fancy about the plants we eat, written in whimsical, discursive style, best suited to this sort of personally conducted tour through a new world. If you pick the book up casually, you are not likely to put it down carelessly, for it catches hold of your attention from the very first pages and holds it entertainingly and amusingly until the end. I found this book on my parents' bookshelf many, many, many years ago. And it's surprising to me that I don't actually have the book memorized, because I've read it over so many times. I love this author. Vernon Quinn has written several other very interesting books. This is the only one in my possession at the moment. I think she has something like close to 20 books under her belt, but some of them biographies, some of them travel books, but she writes a lot about gardening and flowers and things that grow in the garden and legends associated with those plants. And I've told, I think I have told a couple stories from this book on air before, but I'm branching out in new directions. First of all, I want to share the incredible list of greens that Vernon Quinn has explanations and stories about in this book. It's not a big book. It's large print, and it's just over 200 pages, 240 pages or so. But so many wonderful stories. So dandelions, Taraxacum officinale, endive, Cichorium endiva, garden cress, also known as pepper cress, kale, Brassica oleracea, acephala, lamb's lettuce, Valerinella olitoria, lettuce, wild lettuce, mustard, onion tops, parsley, patience dock, turnip greens, beet greens, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, Chinese cabbage, wild cabbage, cardoon, chard, chervil, chicory, collards, corn salad, vegetable oyster, sorrel, salsify, spinach, watercress. It just goes on and on and on. And every one of these has some kind of a story attached to it. Some of them are fairy tales, some of them are folk tales, some of them are botanical historical tales. And then there's the list of recipes in the back of the book. Beet tart, cabbage goose sandwich, cabbage with marrow bones, chicory salad, kale in peas, lettuce salad, lettuce succot, parsley sauce, and spinach tart. And some of these recipes are from the 13 and 1400s. So it's just fascinating reading. So one of the stories, I think probably many of our listeners know the story of Rapunzel, which is another name for romaine or lettuce, and a kind of green. And I'm not going to tell that original story of Rapunzel, although I certainly could, and I have my own version of romaine, of the story of the girl with the long locks who escapes from the wicked woman in the tower. But I will tell this one story that I found a while ago, and I've been thinking about telling it ever since I found it. And this seems like a good opportunity. So this story is about chicory, which I think I already gave the botanical name for chicory, but I can give it again. It's Cichorium intibus, sometimes called succory. It's related to endive, but it is its own separate plant. You may know it as an ingredient in coffee, especially used in the South to flavor coffee and also to stretch coffee, because it's much cheaper to grow chicory than it is to grow coffee plants. But this story is very old. European. In Rumania, so this is just reading from Vernon Quinn's book. In Romanian folklore, chicory was once a blue-eyed princess who was so lovely that the sun passing overhead as she walked in the garden, fell in love with her. But she repulsed his advances, and in pique, he turned her into a flower whose blue eyes must watch him the whole day through, from the moment he rose until at last he set. This she did for a long while, absorbing the luster of his bright rays in her vivid flowers. And then she remembered her fairy godmother, who had watched over her from babyhood and called upon this fairy to undo the sun's mischief and restore her to human form. The godmother's magic, her fairy magic, was not strong enough to counter the sun's magic. The very best she could do was to enable the chicory princess to close all her flowers at noon, so her hours of watching the ardent sun would not be so long. But the princess remained forever a flower, chicory flower, with bright blue flowers in the garden and growing wild in the fields. There's another version of that folktale told in Germany that's told about plantain, which grows in fields wild. Some people eat those plantain leaves. And chicory in that story was a blue-eyed fräulein whose sweetheart was called away a few days before they were to be married. And the weeks passed and the months, and he did not return. Day after day, the sorrowing fräulein stood by the roadside, waiting for her true love, watching for him, until at last the gods took pity on her and turned her into the blue-flowered roadside chicory, so that everywhere she grew, she could look for her lost love.
Wow, those are both very sad.
They are. A lot of, you know, plant stories are sad for some reason.
I know. That's a shame. Yeah. Once you get turned into a plant, I don't see any possibility that you're going to get back to being a lady again. So that sounds like one of those strange things.
Especially if the sun god was the one who transformed. Yeah,
that's funny. People, it's interesting how people think of, or did think, I guess maybe even today, there are people who think of those strange things around us, like trees and the stars and the moon and all that stuff, as having some kind of powers over us, you know.
Well, they do. Have you tried chicory lately?
Huh?
Have you tried eating chicory lately? Chicory.
No. Yeah, when I was a kid, I was taught that that's called hickory. I know people have a big debate over that sometimes, but I remember because that is what was in the kind of coffee that my mother used all the time.
Right.
You know, and I remember someplace saying something about it and being corrected by a teacher in school and saying that's mispronounced. You don't say that, it's not pronounced with the C and all. Anyway, I just...
That's news to me.
Well, I don't know if it's even true, but being a young kid, I try to listen to my teachers sometimes.
Wow.
You know, anyway, it's me. The names for flowers and fruits and all that stuff. But when I was little, it really puzzled me that they have names, and I never asked anybody really when I was little, because a lot of adults didn't talk to kids when I was little. My mother was busy taking care of the house, cleaning and working hard and everything, and giving me jobs to do. And I found out that asking her questions usually didn't get me good answers. And I could ask my father questions when he came home from work, but he would often say about foodstuffs and things, unless he really knew something. He would say, why don't you check with your mother about that? Dad was better about, you know, mechanical devices and motors and stuff, and, you know, cutting down trees and stuff like that. So anyway, but I always found it was interesting. And then as I got older, and started finding out that people gave names to everything, everything. And it didn't make any difference. In a lot of cases, it didn't make any difference what color it was, where it grew, how tall, anything. They just gave it a name. Now, a lot of names were given to food stuff that was based on what, either what they look like or maybe what they tasted like, and from the, you know, from a certain language, you know, Russian or German or French or something. But for a long time, I just thought people were crazy and that they made up names for things based on, you know, their feelings at the time or something. Then as I got older, and I, even now, as I at my age now, as an older person, I understand that people really did, they did have a reason for the names they picked in most cases. Whereas I, as a kid, I just thought, boy, that's a strange thing to call that thing a poinsettia. What the point, what is pointy about that thing? And it's not sitting anyplace. And it's, you know, it's really puzzling. Because in school, they try to tell us what the words meant and why they meant something. And now we look at a plant, you know, at Christmas time, this red thing, and think, it's not pointing. And of course, it's just sitting there. It doesn't have legs, so it's not moving. And right. So I was very confused as a young child. Probably still, at times, I'm confused, you know, about things when they're named. So, and just recently, I realized I live in a town called Martinsburg. And in this town, in my neighborhood, every street is named after a state. And there's a Martinsburg Street. There's a West Virginia Avenue. And I thought, boy, these guys have no imagination whatsoever. They just got it out of map and started naming streets based on, you know. So I live in the middle of a very southern neighborhood. Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, all avenues. And it just seems interesting. Anyway, it's nothing to do with food. So I thought I would tell another story.
Yeah.
If that's okay.
Yeah. Good.
So I spoke about elementary school and high school food. After high school, I made this momentous decision, which turned out to be a great decision. At the time, almost everybody thought I was insane. I might have been at the time, but it turned out to be a great decision. At 17, not quite 18 years old, I decided to join the Army. And I did. I joined the Army. July 31st, I got on, I went down to Fort Hollibird. And sure enough, they swore me in, took me down to the train station with a whole bunch of other guys, sent me to South Carolina. And I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, but Fort Jackson was in that area. And that's where I found out that in spite of all the craziness and all the strange things that they did in the Army, the one thing that the United States Army believed in was feeding their soldiers well. And I learned early on that if you want to have a good friend in the Army, one of them should be the cooks. I learned early on, be nice to the cooks. In fact, I volunteered for KP right away, my first week in the Army, first week in basic training, because the sergeant pointed out that if you do, you probably have to do a week KP during, you know, stay here. And smart people might get it done early, because if you've done it, they won't pick you again until they get desperate and, you know, run out of bodies. And so I rose my hand right away, and that impressed Sergeant Dixon, who was my platoon sergeant. Anyway, it was fun. I had learned to do dishes at home. I washed the dishes. I scrubbed the floors. I cleaned the windows and stuff. I was good at stuff like that because my mother had me do it. And I was the baby of the family, so I got a lot of chores. But it turned out that being able to do good work and being small, I remember the first job I had in the kitchen was at the end of my first day on the KP, scrubbing the oven.
Oh.
I was small enough, I could open the big oven door and I could get in there and I could scrub it up. And I remember the guy I was working, another guy I was working with said, I can't believe you're like smiling and singing and everything. This is hard work. I said, man, this is nothing. Sarge is leaving us alone. He told us to take a break if we needed a cup of coffee or a drink or something. If I was at home, my mother would be checking on me, everything, and finding fault with this area, that area, get that better, you know. And this is fun. So anyway, I learned to appreciate the cooking of the people and the sergeants in the Army, the cooks. And the other thing about the food in the Army was, from my very first meal in basic training, going through the line, went through the line with a tray and they piled stuff on, you know, and all you had to do was stand there a little extra and again, they'd put more on. You know, there wasn't always a lot of talk and, you know, you weren't selecting things so much as just walk in front of the guy with the ladle. And if he had scrambled eggs, he's going to put a bunch of scrambled eggs. If you stand there and looked at him and smiled, he'd put some more on there. And you could get fried eggs, you know, and you could get scrambled eggs and you could get an omelet. And they just piled the food on, pancakes, toast. And then I discovered a delightful thing that most of the guys that I went in with, a bunch of guys from Baltimore, turned their nose up at. But there was this thing, and a guy had a bowl in his hand and scooped a big ladle full of this white stuff, creamy stuff, put it on my tray before I even thought about it. And I just went, when I sat down, the guy sat across from me, I didn't know him, I introduced myself. He said, "Do you like grits?" I said, "I don't know, but they smell good and let's see." And he said, "Man, you're not very big. That plate looks..." I said, "My father told me you're going to be hungry all the time because he's going to work you to death." And man, that turned out to be true. In basic training, I went in the Army, weighed 110 pounds. So it was a little under 5'6". Well, I came out of basic training at about 112 pounds. I didn't gain a lot of weight, but I gained muscle. And I ate good because my dad told me, he said, "They're going to work you to death, so you better make sure you eat a good breakfast every day. You're going to be hungry all day long." And it turned out to be true. I could not wait for supper at night. You know, I never missed a meal. There were guys who would say, "I'm tired. I can't go. I'm not going down to the mess hall." Not me. I made sure I ate every meal. And it was smart because I was really never hungry. I never felt over full either because they really did work us hard. And the food they made was really good. And the nice thing about it was you didn't have to take everything. You could walk right by liver. You know, you could walk right by something you didn't like and just keep them going. And always plenty of milk to drink, always plenty of coffee to drink. And in the Army, I always thought it was wonderful. I never complained about the food. I found out when I went to Germany, I had two exceptional experiences with food in Germany. One is I used to make supply runs to a place called Spangdahlem in Germany. I had a Jeep assigned to me. I would get in a Jeep. I would drive to Spangdahlem. It was about 65 kilometers. And I would go there three times a week for supplies because I was in a Nike Ajax missile outfit. And I was in the radar section. And our radar and computer vans were powered by 5,000 tubes. There were no such things as chips and transducers and all those other fancy things that now could make you carry a phone around in your pocket that can do it just about anything. The computer that I took care of the supplies for was in a van 40 feet long. And the men who worked on those that computer, the radar men, had to check every 2 hours. Some tubes were checked. Every 4 hours, other tubes were checked. Every 6 hours, other tubes were checked. Every 8 hours, other tubes were checked. And then they did the 2, 4, 6, and 8 checks over and over and over. 24 hours a day, there was somebody coming in into the computer van, and they were checking. And they would come to my supply van and saying, I need this. I need this. Give me a piece of paper. And they would need, 54, 55s or AX42B, some kind of tube. And I had to keep record of those. And then when we got closer, because of that, I would go to Spangdahlem. And they had an Air Force base there. It was both an Air Force base and an Army base, side by side. Well, if we were in the service at the time, you could eat in the Air Force mess hall. I ate lunch in the Air Force mess hall every time I went to Spangdahlem. The Air Force food was even better than the Army food. I couldn't believe it, because the Air Force, they really did have lots of different desserts and stuff like that. And that was a real pleasure. I thought it was just absolutely wonderful. So, that kind of thing just set me up. When I got out of the Army, and I went to college, I was out of the Army for maybe 5 weeks before I started college. College story is a whole nother thing, but right from the beginning, these young boys, I was 21 when I started college, and most of the guys in my class were 17 or 18. And I just laughed at them. They complained about the food. Oh, this food is, this is not like my mommy's food. And so I laughed like crazy, because I just filled up my tray and I ate. I mean, it's hard to mess up breakfast. I would agree with them sometimes, and some of the meals that were made were like not the best in the world, but you cannot mess up a breakfast. I don't care how bad a cook you are. You can't mess up scrambled eggs. And you can't mess up bacon unless you don't fry it at all. And you can't mess up sausage. And you can't mess up cereal. How can you mess up oatmeal? Just put a bunch of sugar in it, or brown sugar or something. And it's delicious. And I followed my father's whatever that thing was, his education, and ate. Because in college, I was playing soccer. I was studying hard. I was up late at night. And I needed food. 4 years in college, I did not gain a whole lot of weight. I did gain, by the time I was a senior, I was 160 pounds, which was practically fat compared to when I started. I started my freshman year as a senior. I'm a freshman year of college at 120 pounds. And I was encouraged by my soccer coach to gain some weight. Especially after my first game in my first regular game in college soccer, I broke 2 ribs. Never missed any games in 4 years of soccer, but I wound up wearing a flak jacket after that first game to protect my ribs. And he suggested that maybe I should pile on some pounds and some muscle since I was so small. And I was playing on the line where I got knocked down a lot. And it helped out. I gained about 10, 15 pounds each year until my senior year when I weighed 160 pounds. And it was because of that good food. I laughed all 4 years at the guys who cried about their mother's cooking and how the restaurants were terrible in Emmitsburg, Maryland. and they were, what they were terrible is they were terrible in being there. They didn't hardly have any restaurants. There were like three restaurants in the whole area. And, you know, later on in my college career, we did go out, you know, a few miles here and there and find small towns that had nice restaurants. But I never understood the babies who complained about the food. You know, I always felt they must have had some really, really fancy stuff. But they complained even about the way the toast was done. You know, how bad can you complain about toast? You know, even if it's burned a little bit, just put some jelly on it and eat it down. So anyway,
how was the Air Force food better? Tell me about that.
Well, the Air Force, it was, I'm not sure. That's a picture. This, the guys doling out the Army food were closer to the kind of sad sack stories you see about in the old, you know, newspaper comic strips, you know, about a guy there, you know, in a shirt, a white shirt stained, or, you know, scooping out stuff and just slapping it, you know, and you go through the lines. And whereas in the Air Force, the guys behind the Air Force took more pride in their service. They had, their uniforms were neater, and they would actually speak to you as almost as if you were at a restaurant. Would you like some of this, or would you prefer this kind of soup or that kind of soup? And it was so much different. It was like being treated like a human being, whereas in the Army, they just treated you like a hungry person. Dump food on there. So anyway, the Air Force was, I always like eating in their cafeteria. They seemed to take, I think they did it on purpose. They sort of took pity on the soldiers who ate in their cafeteria. They knew that the soldiers liked the food there. And so they liked it that we thought of them as being better, and they treated us better. That was my take on it. You know, so
that's good.
Yeah.
Good okay. Story, Stosh.
Thanks. Can you give me? Oh, you know what? I just
we're
want
almost
to mention,
out of time.
I yeah. know, and because I do need to be ready to go. So.
Okay, well, I was just going to say a few more things about dreams, but we could just end now if you are eager to do that. We
or
do have
you could
a few
just,
more minutes.
You could just finish it, and I will excuse myself and leave early.
Okay.
Thank you.
Have fun on your tour.
Okay. Right. And thank right. thank John
thank you,
very
Stosh.
Much for me. Okay. Right.
I will. Okay.
So long. Well, see you next week.
Yes, you will.
All right. Bye.
So the last thing from Vernon Quinn that I'm going to talk about is a little bit of a story about Cardoon, which is part of the thistle family. The Latin name is Cynara cardumculus. Cynara cardumculus. And it was developed from wild thistles. Vernon herself says that no doubt the ancients had been planting thistles for a long time, or at least gathering thistles for a long time. So cardoon was developed by the ancients from wild thistles, and therefore is more thistle-like than its cousin from the same source, because it was developed for a much longer period. The cousin, which is in the thistle family, is the artichoke, but of course has developed into a very different plant. Cardoon is little grown in America as a garden vegetable, but in Europe it's relished, where the leaf stalks and large mid-ribs of the leaves are blanched, and the roots and the prickly leaves are also eaten. Like its wild thistle relatives, it's beautiful and decorative when permitted to bear its many flowers with their purple magenta shade accented with gray-green leaves. So no wonder the worthy Herodotus, the Greek tale teller who called himself a historian, reports that at the bearing of the flower, the grasshoppers do loudest sing. And I have actually eaten thistle leaves myself because I found a wild thistle in my garden a long time ago, and I decided they were so beautiful that I was going to let it flower. And it almost took over my entire yard. It took me 3 hours to dig it up. It was so large and vigorous. And that was my last experiment with thistle. I am not even particularly interested in growing artichokes, although I know they're not quite that hardy, but still, they're a little scary to me. So I will continue to read Vernon Quinn's book and learn more about greens and continue to listen to Stash Silkowski's stories about food, because they are so very different from my own stories. But I am going to close out the show at this point. You've been listening to Fanny Crawford and Stash Silkowski, who has already departed the show, but we'll be back next week, both of us. We are the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Martinsburg, West Virginia, Bolivar, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. Independent community radio online and on the air. And we offer our listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging you, our listening community, to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for John Case playing
Roots. Very roots, deep roots. Deep roots. We're probably going to be doing some new material from the Steep Canyon Rangers.
Is that who I heard on air this morning when I first tuned in?
Yeah, they were doing, a Robbie Folks folk song.
All right.
He's another interesting guy that's, I heard about years ago.
He was telling a story when I first tuned
in. Yeah, right. He has he's an unbelievable, he's a killer guitar player, okay, but he's stayed in the folk country tradition and mostly acoustic, and he has he's gifted. I don't know.
Say his name one more time.
Robbie Folks, F-U-L-K-S.
And, F-U-L-K-S, okay. Yeah.
And the Steep Canyon Rangers are a wonderful bluegrass band from North Carolina, mostly. And there's a lot of music coming out of North Carolina. They got famous because of Steve Martin, who